Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. If you're looking to get out of the heat in a different way, a way that is unique, inspiring, and stimulating, we have a couple of suggestions. The current exhibits at both the Mint Museum of Art and the Beckler Museum of Modern Art. We're going to visit with the curators of both those organizations this hour. Later, we hear about something that may be difficult to imagine, and that alone may draw you into the Beckler's exhibit of more than 60 paintings, sculptures, and works on paper. And what makes it difficult to imagine is that it was designed by a Charlotte-based dancer and choreographer who is nearly blind. And so this exhibit, Collection Reframed, We Are Here Beyond Vision, uses immersive video and spatial audio and other techniques to transform how you engage with visual art. That's later in the program. We start with an exhibition at the Mint Museum of the works of famed photographer Annie Leibovitz. It celebrates her 50-year career, with the collection spanning from her early black and white works to her more recently conceptual portraits of everyone from Queen Elizabeth to Charlotte's own Hugh McCall. Jennifer Siddle Edwards is the chief curator and curator of contemporary art at the Mint Museum, and she joins us right now to take us through that exhibit. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Mike. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Annie Leibovitz is iconic, perhaps among the most famous photographers and consequential photographers, I was going to say of our lifetime, but perhaps of all time. I mean, her work is truly consequential. She's been named a living legend by the Library of Congress, and I would imagine that even if somebody listening right now doesn't know Annie Leibovitz's name, they have seen her work, and we're likely taken by it. So what makes it so special?
I mean, I think your use of the word consequential is so spot on. She is famous, of course, for photographing the famous and influential. But I think what's most important about her is that she has really been able to see why audiences kind of elevate these famous people to such heights because of something inside the culture, inside individuals. And she's able to photograph that in the portraits that she creates, in the settings that she chooses. And I think over the last 50 years, how she has photographed these famous people and cultural icons is what we've come to expect from our cultural figures. And that's where that consequential piece comes in, and why we felt it was important to bring this exhibition to the Mint Museum, because her work tells us so much about ourselves as an audience and as a society in the United States.
She came to the forefront, not even the forefront, she came into the zeitgeist in the early 1970s when she was hired by Rolling Stone magazine to be their chief photographer. Mm-hmm. But that was really early in her life as a photographer. What did they see in her that clearly was accurate, because it just exploded from that point on? What did they see in her?
Yeah, there are a couple of things. Annie Leibovitz moves to San Francisco to go to the Art Institute of San Francisco in 1967, the same year Jan and Jane Wenner start Rolling Stone in San Francisco. And when she shows up in the offices in 1970, a student, right? She's still at the Art Institute. And she comes in after an anti-war protest that she had attended the day before, and she spent all night printing these photographs. And she comes in, and the story is she still had the sepia, she still had the processing ink on her fingers. And the magazine was so impressed, not only that she got this incredibly powerful photograph, but she turned it around immediately. And as you know, being in news and daily news, you need to be able to deliver powerful, good summations of major events quickly to be able to get it out into the public. So
she wasn't posing those pictures. She was capturing the moment, and to capture the moment takes incredible skill, it seems to me.
And that intimacy that she gets, like that capturing of the moment, is incredibly powerful and exceptional for Leibovitz. And she really planned this exhibition, and she starts it off with a series of photographs of famous people or important people, you know, some are writers we may not recognize right away, in cars. And it runs from 1970 to 1984, so 14 years. And you immediately see this intimacy, this relationship that she can develop with her subjects immediately. And some of her fellow writers at Rolling Stone attribute it to the fact that she was so young and she was so seemingly awkward and new at what she was doing. And it was disarming for these very successful, famous, worshipped icons, right? Like John Lennon and Mick Jagger and, you know, the Grateful Dead and David Crosby. And they would see this awkward young girl, and they would immediately feel this compassion or sensitivity towards her, and that would create this intimacy immediately. Or they'd get so freaked out that she was so awkward and uncomfortable that they would get like very standoffish and uncomfortable. And that also would create this incredible intimacy and vulnerability. And that, I think, is what comes out in the photographs, whether they're these staged posed portraits or if they are these candids that she's taking.
You're the curator of contemporary art at the Mint Museum of Art, and there may be people who look at a photograph and think, well, it's not a painting, it's not a drawing, it's not a sculpture. How can it be art? What makes it art?
Oh gosh, Mike,
Because
such a
it's
complicated
because
question.
it was captured by a machine. And that's
Oh, we're
what
going to
people
talk
can't
about
get beyond.
mechanic reproductions. So this exhibition is actually complicated for two reasons in regards to your question. Number one, basic photography, your mechanical reproduction question. I mean, photography is an art in itself. Printing a photograph, measuring color, light, composition, these are all things that are done by a photographer with chemicals and with a machine for sure, that are equivalent to a painter using a brush or a sculptor using marble or whatever fine material that you want to reference as like the epitome of art making. It's all about craft. All of this is about craft. And the craft in making a photograph is just as important and delicate and thoughtful as any of those other forms.
Because
But with this show, oh, sorry, go
no,
on.
I was gonna go ahead. Go ahead.
But this show in particular is complicating that question because these are work prints. These are not, Annie Leibovitz is actually known as an exceptional printer and colorist. But these photographs are studio prints and they're put up into the wall with push pins. So these are not precious objects. What these photographs are showing us is the conceptual project, the work, which is the title of the show, that Leibovitz invests in creating these images that then become, as you said, these qu consequential material objects that are capturing our culture and the United States cultural history. So that conceptual project, I would say, is very evident in this exhibition and what elevates photography and any medium into the realm of an artwork.
She has photographed because of her work for Rolling Stone and her immense talent, which obviously became apparent to everybody who saw it over the years in Rolling Stone. And then she moved on to Vanity Fair and she moved on to Vogue, etc. She has, as a result of that, photographed some of the most famous people of our time. But somehow her photographs of people like rock legends and movie stars seem to show a side of these individuals that hasn't been or wasn't captured by other photographers in other photographs. That's talent, that's artistry, and that talent is sometimes undefinable, it seems to me. Can this ability be defined? Can she define it? Has
Oh
she
my
ever
goodness.
talked about that?
I mean, no, she's very, I mean, she shows it in this exhibition for sure. I mean, she set it up in a way that you understand the exceptional ability to get to this intimacy, but also to set up these portraits that are very metaphorically revealing or literally revealing an essence of the person she's photographing. That very much is a gift that is specific to her. And what she talks about mainly is her camera use, like these technical things or the stories behind the staging of things, like why Meryl Streep's face is painted white for the cover of Rolling Stone. And I think it was 1980 when she's promoting French Lieutenant's Women, or the Blues Brothers being blue, or Whoopi Goldberg in the bath of milk, or Demi Moore pregnant and naked with just that 30-carat diamond ring on her finger as dressing. I mean, those. She talks about those things, but it's really walking through the history of her career that you begin to realize the conceptual project that she's been doing and the thoughtfulness that goes into it. And that's not something, I think that's something you need to experience and think about for yourself. And she very intentionally limited the amount of wall text on the wall. There are a lot of areas where you don't have the names on the wall. There's a QR code so you can look it up there. There's a cheat sheet on benches. But really, she wants you to look at these images, and sure, you're going to recognize some of them. But I think she really wants us to discover for ourselves why these images are powerful and why you're curious about some people who you may not know who they are. And that's been interesting on the tours, is people will zone in on someone and say, who is that? Not because they don't recognize the person, but because there's something really beautiful or provocative or intimate about the image. And they want to know why this image was developed from someone who isn't recognizable. And that's been curious.
We're talking about the exhibit now at the Mint Museum of Art through the 31st of August, Annie Leibovitz's work on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. She obviously played a defining role. You have said that she played a defining role, and you're talking about it right now, and how these works of arts are exhibited. As you said, they're just photographs with push pins, as you would put them up on a bulletin board. On the wall. They're not in frames. They're not spaced out like you would expect an art gallery to space out the images. They're just up there in a row, several different rows across the entire room. Why?
Again, that idea of this is work. Leibovitz wanted the walls to be homosote, which is kind of like, I mean, literally like a very thick bulletin board. And you see that when you go to photography studios, you see it in magazine offices, right? Because that's how you do layouts. That's how you shift story pages around or photographs around to figure out the best narrative that you can come up with to tell your story visually as powerfully as you can. And so this idea of her process and her project being something that's very thoughtful and intentional and work is something that is being drilled down in this exhibition. I mean, you said, like, we think of her as the photographing these iconic people in beautiful settings, wearing incredible clothes, Rihanna in Cuba in this gorgeous Swarovski crystal gown. And but yes, she's photographing beautiful people in beautiful settings, and that's a leg up to an incredible photograph, but it's the thoughtfulness and it's the process and it's the incredible diligence that she has in creating these images that has made her the icon. And so she wants, I think, for us to realize the thought process and the conceptual project behind her 50-year career.
Jennifer Suttle Edwards is the chief curator and the curator of contemporary art at the Mint Museum. We're talking about a current exhibit that's up there only through the end of August, August 31st. Annie Leibovitz's work is the name of the exhibit, and also an exhibit of her work. And there are multiple meanings in why it's called that. We're going to continue talking about that. And later in the program, we'll hear about a unique exhibit at the museum next door, the Beckler, which uses sound to help visually impaired people navigate the world of visual art. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Jennifer Suttle Edwards, chief curator and curator of contemporary art at the Mint Museum of Art Uptown, which is displaying the works of Annie Leibovitz through August 31st. And I want to talk about the title of this again. You've alluded to this already, but the exhibit is called Annie Leibovitz / Work. And there's a purpose in that. So many times people think that artists have a certain amount of talent and they're just suddenly inspired and they whip it out and it's done and it's on the wall and everybody loves it and they buy it or whatever. But it's not that way. There's a process, there is work involved. And certainly, as a person who photographed for Rolling Stone, covering major events of our time or rock concerts where she has to capture the moment that means something, that takes an eye, but it also takes work. And her work in the dark room, her work with, I guess, the digital version of dark rooms today, is all part of the work. Why was it important to her, since she's so involved in this, to point out that what she does may be artistry, but it's also work?
I think because there is this sensitivity that's come out more and more in recent decades, this idea of the artistic genius, and that you just are sitting around and you're suddenly inspired and you go and you create the thing. And I mean, I know we certainly, and Katya can speak to this too, we feel this in the museum business, that there's something very passive or very easy about the work that's being done in cultural institutions. And the fact of the matter is, it is a constant day in, day out struggle. Leibovitz went on the road and had to not only keep up with her subject. So if she's on a campaign trail, she has to be all day with the candidates, which is, as you know, Mike, 6 a.m. until 2 a.m. And then she has to process her film and send things in. So even when her subject's day ends, no matter how dedicated and diligent they are, she still has hours of work that she has to do afterwards. And this idea of it just being, something that magically appears in this camera, she looks through a viewfinder and this mechanical instrument creates this image, is something that I think she really wants to disabuse us of, that it is this incredible, arduous, exhausting, and rewarding process. But the physical labor, the emotional labor, and the conceptual labor that goes into it is quite taxing. And the images she chose really reveal that. It's interesting too. I'm sorry, I'm gonna just a second. She chose a lot of images from stories that are very famous that aren't necessarily what ran in the magazine or that you would think of as being important from that series. And when you go through, you realize it's a lot of images of exhaustion, like Mick Jagger and Keith Richards exhausted trying to recover from these long tour dates. And the McGovern campaign, Hunter S. Thompson and McGovern and all of his campaign people exhausted after being on the trail, instead of that vital, like in the thick of it, action shot.
She has some very famous photographs that even if you don't know her name, you've seen the photograph and probably marveled at the photograph or gotten something out of it that you didn't think you would get out of a photograph. And some of those photographs are included in this exhibit, but as you point out, there are a lot of others that never that hit the cutting room floor, so to speak. They were not published. These are behind the scenes photographs. And I'm curious how that adds seeing these pictures in context or in conjunction with the other more famous images, how this informs our understanding or adds to our understanding of her work.
I think it really does show that conceptual heft that's going into the images. I mean, everyone stops in front of that beautiful portrait of Yoko Ono and John Lennon. It's iconic. It's Lennon curled up nude around Yoko Ono's clothed body, and they're on the floor of their Dakota apartment. And it's this incredibly, like, moving, tender, intimate moment. And Leibovitz had known them for a decade at this point. And it's so just beautiful. And when John Lennon saw the test Polaroid right after Leibovitz shot the photograph, he said, "This is it. This is exactly my relationship with Yoko. And this is beautiful. It's perfect." And then he's murdered a few hours later, and it becomes the last portrait of them together, the last photo, significant photograph of Lennon. And that juxtaposed with all of these other reportage photographs that she's doing, her coverage of Sarajevo, which hasn't really been seen, like that adds this kind of urgent importance to considering these images beyond just, wow, look at Demi Moore. She's a gorgeous pregnant lady. Like it transcends that.
It kind of snowballed over her career because of the images that she took and became famous for. People, I would think, would want her to photograph them. If you're going to have to endure a sitting, it might as well be with Annie Leibovitz. And she had tremendous access to some of the biggest and most important and influential people of our time, including, I didn't know this till yesterday, Queen Elizabeth. I knew she'd taken a picture of her or two. She has taken many photographs of the former queen, the late Queen of England, many times alone, with her sister Margaret, with her corgis, with the late Prince Philip, in settings both grand and ordinary and intimate, sometimes at the same time. Which of these photographs appear in this exhibit?
The photograph of her, it's so interesting how you described all of that. The photograph of her in her sitting room in the palace, that's the one that's included in the exhibition. And it's true, she's taken pictures of the queen many times, in many circumstances, but it's wonderful. I love this whole idea that so Queen Elizabeth gave her 20 minutes for that first set, for that first shoot. She was like, you have 20 minutes, I'll do whatever, but 20 minutes and that's it. And I'm not leaving this room. I'm staying in this room and you take whatever you want in this room. And Leibovitz really wanted her outside in like a Shakespearean setting in the garden with like, clouds rolling in and, to because the monarchy was always under so much controversy and threat, particularly at that time. And Queen Elizabeth is like, no, I'm not leaving this room. I'll put on the cloak, but I'm not leaving this room. And so Leibovitz shoots her in the cloak and then of course like takes her image outside with the roiling clouds and darkened skies in the garden and just puts the queen for in there digitally and is able to create the image that she wants. And this is something that she always was doing. She hasn't started doing digital until quite late. But that idea of creating the scene is something that she she's always very talented at.
I'm glad you told me that she digitally inserted the queen into that scene where the sky is a roiling bunch of grayness, and the trees are bare on either side of her, and she's in this black cloak with only gold buttons, and really the only color in the photograph is coming from the queen's face, which makes it a remarkable work. And I thought that she had been outside in the forest. I'm glad you told me that she digitally manipulated that. If you're going to shoot a queen, you might as well shoot a king. And she's done that in this exhibit because of a photograph that the Mint commissioned Annie Leibovitz to take. And I'm talking about a recent photograph that was taken sometime between February and today of former Bank of America CEO Hugh McColl, who built that bank from nothing and who essentially built Charlotte into the city that it is today. How did that photograph come to be?
I just want to say, when you said King, I thought you were going to say the Muhammad Ali portrait that she did. And when you went to Hugh McColl, I was like, oh, of course. So that came about actually. The Mint helped with the commission, but it was actually paid for by a number of friends to honor Mr. McColl on his 90th birthday. And it was a long negotiation of where it was going to be taken. It was going to be Charlotte because this is where, as you said, his career and the all these monumental changes he made in the finance industry happened. And then it was going to be in Annie's studio behind her traditional gray background. So there would have that gravitas to it. And then Leibovitz, who did not know who Hugh McColl was when she was approached, did her research as she always does. She also always commits 2 days to spend with the person. 2 full days, no matter who it is. And so she said, you know what? He has this ranch in Texas. I think that is going to be the place where he will be most comfortable, most relaxed.
So when I saw this image, I thought this is a counterpoint to the queen in the wilderness,
Oh, and it
because
is, Mike,
okay,
entirely.
because he's standing in this amber field of waving grain or tall grass. The sky is deeply blue, but it's mottled with bright white clouds, and he is standing there in a pair of jeans held up by a belt with a big silver belt buckle and wearing a black cowboy hat. That's not the Hugh McCall we know as the banker. His face is what pops despite all of that activity in the background. Why that setting? Why those clothes?
Those are from his closet. So she pulls clothes from his closet. Though when Mr. McCall saw them lying on the bed, he was like, "Where'd you get these clothes? I'm not wearing these clothes." And she was like, "They're from your closet. They're your clothes." But the idea of, Hugh McCall tore down borders. Like, he made trans-state commerce, I'm probably using the wrong words here, possible. And that completely changed the financial structure and the way banks operate in this country. That is frontier stuff. And so taking the picture of him as this, like still, and he's 90, that virile, tall standing, it's like Alan Ladd in Shane. He totally looks like this towering figure, which he was in his field. And when, can I just tell you one thing? When Mr. McCall walked in and saw that portrait, he was just kind of shocked. And I was worried. And I was like, "Do you like it? Is it okay? What's wrong?" And he was like, "I was never standing in that field. I don't understand. Where did this picture come from?" And like with the Queen, Leibovitz had waited for that perfect sky, took the picture. They had been driving around in Mr. McCall's Jeep on the land. She said, "Stop the Jeep," jumped out, took this photograph of the storm coming in, and then took the portrait of Mr. McCall back around the house. I'm not exactly sure where, and then inserted it in that.
Hugh McCall is very rarely wrong, but he said he didn't think there would be much interesting to see in a photograph of him taken by Annie Leibovitz. He says there's not much you can do with a 90-year-old face. But guess what? He was wrong. In this exhibit, Bruce Springsteen, I believe this is all accurate, Bruce Springsteen, Dolly Parton, Whoopi Goldberg, Serena and Venus Williams, Johnny Depp, Barack Obama, Quentin Tarantino, and many, many more people. How many images in all?
Oh my gosh. There are over 300 photographs, and then there are over 200 digital images on the digital screens that Leibovitz is working on now. And we will be doing a special closing on August 31st. I'll be giving a lecture that will start at 1 o'clock. And then the exhibition will be open for free that final day. But people will have to register online beforehand because it is the last day and it's the only free day that we will be having. So.
And this runs at the Mint Uptown through August 31st. Once again, it's called Annie Leibovitz Work. Jennifer Soudal Edwards, thank you for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate it too.
Now on to a different kind of art exhibition. It contains painting, sculpture, and more, but it invites us to experience what is normally a visual form in a different way through sound. The Beckner Museum of Modern Art's exhibit Collection Reframed, We Are Here Beyond Vision, explores the human body in all of its complexity with the works from some of the greats of the 20th century and was created and assembled in part by a Charlotte-based dancer and choreographer, Davian Robinson, who is nearly blind. This exhibit answers the question, how do you experience visual art if you can't see? How indeed? Let's find out. Katia Zavistovsky is the curator of the Beckler Museum of Modern Art, and she joins us for the remainder of the program. Welcome.
Morning, Mike. It's an honor to be on.
Thank you. Visual art is presumed to be for the sighted, and that leaves a large portion of the population out of the loop when it comes to serious visual art exhibitions. Where did this idea for trying to do something with immersive audio so that people who are visually impaired can enjoy the art come from?
Well, this exhibition is part of a new series that the Bechtler has launched called Collection Reframed. And for this summer exhibition series, we're inviting contemporary artists and creatives like Davian Robinson to be in conversation with the museum's permanent collection. And so for this inaugural presentation, we collaborated with Davian and Janet Biggs, who is a New York-based visual artist. Janet and Davian have collaborated together for a number of years now to create immersive video and sound installations.
And we're going to be exploring this as we go through the remainder of the hour here on WFAE's Charlotte Talks. I want to talk later about how the two of them met and came together to collaborate on this and other activities. But first of all, I mentioned that they're accomplishing this through immersive audio and yes. data sonification.
Yes.
I don't know what data sonification is, so people may be unaware of what this is. Explain it.
So first I'll just back up quickly just to say that when we first started talking with Janet and Davian about this project, one of the first things that we talked about is, you know, how could Davian, who is vision impaired, curate an art exhibition? What kind of experience does he have going to an art museum? And how might we invite visitors to experience art not just with their eyes, but through sound and touch and movement and, you know, just feeling with their full bodies, you know, creating this sort of immersive sensorial kind of field. And so one of the works in the show, which is titled Data Sonification, I think it's one of my favorite works in the show. And I think it's a great example of both how Janet and Davian, you know, were in conversation with the museum's historical collection of modern art, but also how we can expand, you know, the ways that we perceive visual art. Again, tuning in not just with your eyes. And so to create this work, they chose three works from the museum's permanent collection. The three works are a tapestry by Pablo Picasso, mm-hmm. a sculpture by Barbara Hepworth, and a painting by Maya Godlewska. And they essentially took high resolution photographs of those works and translated that into sound using technology.
And when we come back, we're going to give you a little example of how that works and what it sounds like with Katia Zavistovsky, who is the curator of the Bechtler Museum of Modern Art. Collections Reframed is what we're talking about. It's Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Katia Zavistovsky. She's the curator of the Bechtler Museum of Modern Art, and we're talking specifically about an exhibit that will be at the museum through September 22nd uptown, Collection Reframed, We Are Here Beyond Vision. It is a collaboration between two people, one of whom is visually impaired, a Charlotte choreographer and dancer, who helped design this exhibition. And before we hear how this works, I want to go back to something. How do you have somebody who is visually impaired and perhaps has never, prior to this exhibit, has never been able to truly understand or enjoy or appreciate a visual art exhibit? How do you have that person design a visual art exhibit that can be enjoyed by both the visually impaired and the fully sighted?
You know, it's a great question. And as I mentioned, that was really the first sort of topic of discussion when we started this collaboration with Davian and Janet Biggs. And, you know, I would say that for us, for our team, it was through conversation, through describing works of art, and also listening to Davian's, you know, Davian describing his experience. And I thought that he put it so well in a recent interview. He said, if you lead with access, you unlock a whole new realm of artistic possibility. And I thought that that was so well put. And, you know, this was a learning experience for me too, in that When I go to an art museum, I experience the work with my eyes. But that's not the case for everybody. And, whereas for me, my eyes are kind of forefront, for Davian, it's sound and touch. He navigates by echolocation. And so he has a different experience, but it's no less than mine. It's just different.
Different.
And I think embracing that and providing people with more points of access is just a wonderful thing.
So he came up with the two of them, Janet and he came up with this idea of using immersive audio and a gigantic visual stimulation because he can see dark and light,
Yes.
as I understand it, and also something called, which we talked about a little bit, called data sonification. And we have a recording of a small piece of this exhibition and what it might sound, what it does sound like. Not everything sounds like this, but I just want to listen to this and have you explain what it is we're hearing.
Okay.
Okay, now to me, that sounds like tap dancing. And there is a dancer, a choreographer involved in this. Is that what it is, or is it something completely different?
It is in part. So that tapping sound that you hear is Davian. He's tapping. He's using echolocation to navigate, the environment in which he's in. And so that's part of the audio representation. This sound piece that we're hearing right now is the audio representation of a sculpture by Barbara Hepworth. It's a bronze sculpture that's about 6 feet tall, and if you can imagine, sort of an elongated spiral form. And to create the audio, we worked with a spatial sound engineer named Tanner Upthegrove, who used various software programs to translate that visual data of the sculpture into sound to create this soundscape.
So explain to me how this works for a visually impaired person. They're hearing this.
Yes.
And it's
And in fact,
ins
everybody is hearing this.
oh, yes, and it's inspired by this sculpture, which is for lack of a better term, it's kind of a bronze dark sculpture that is
It's like a
several
wave
rings.
form, it, you know, a
Okay.
wave form, a spiral.
So
I think also of like an
So what does
ear.
what we're hearing, how does that inform a visually impaired person about that work of art?
Well, when you walk into the museum, if you the speakers are installed all around the walls of the gallery space, so it truly is a kind of surround sound, spatial sound experience. And to my mind, I love the idea that it connects to Davian's own practice, his own body and his own experience of the world through this, echolocation and tap. But it also, I think, one can think of the sound of the sea, the sound, the sort of spiral form. There's a sort of repetitiveness to the audio. And ultimately, rather than it being a direct one-to-one representation through sound, it's really about being in a space, in a museum, in a gallery, and having an immersive experience where for some reason, so for some people, that immersive experience would be visual, and for others, it would be through other senses.
Well, let me ask you this, since you have been through this exhibit more than once,
Yes.
and you've been involved in this immersive audio, as a sighted person, when you are in there and you're looking at the visual art and you're hearing what we just heard and other things that speak to other works of art, what does the visually unimpaired person get out of this?
Oh, well, I think that it really expands the ways that we can perceive art. It adds another layer. And I think that a lot of sighted people, they don't pay much attention to the sounds around them. And I think for me anyway, it makes me more conscious of the space that I'm in. It also makes it feel like it's more of a shared space. I'm very conscious of the space that I'm in. It compels me to move around the sculpture and to move around the gallery. But it also makes me more conscious of who else is in that space and what they might be experiencing.
We talked in the last segment about the Annie Leibovitz exhibit next door to your museum and about why it's called work, because although there's artistry involved, there is also work involved in all art and the creation of that art. And there's an intersection, and part of that work is kind of scientific. And there's an intersection here in this exhibit of art and science. We have Janet Biggs and Davian Robinson. They are the creators of this, but they worked with, as you've pointed out, an engineer, a physicist, and a mathematician to create this immersive experience. This is really a true blending of art and science. And I would imagine at the start, it's not unlike an artist working with a blank canvas. There's no roadmap, nothing but possibilities. So how long did it take them to hit upon something that worked, that is meaningful for the blind and the partially sighted, and also works for people who are fully sighted?
This working on this exhibition was a fascinating experience for me because I have to be honest, I am a total Luddite. Technology is an enigma to me. I can use my computer and that's about it. So it was really interesting and I learned a lot through, talking with Janet and her team of collaborators, which as you said, included scientists, and learning more about the tech aspects of work and how that can activate museum spaces. Janet, her art practice is incredibly collaborative. And so she has longstanding relationships with engineers, mathematicians, physicists, dancers, and so on. And that's really how her partnership with Davian began. So Janet was commissioned by she was commissioned to do a project at a historical ice house in Sharon, Connecticut. And she reached out to Davian wanting to partner with him on this work. And she was particularly interested in a debate between the American conservatist William F. Buckley Jr. and a blind sailor named James Dixon. And essentially, Buckley was, balking at the idea that Dixon, this blind sailor, would attempt a solo sail across the Atlantic. And he said that it is, profane for a blind person to go to a ballet. And, I'm paraphrasing here, but essentially, how dare this person think that he can sail? And so Janet challenged that assumption. She created this work, this video work, which is on view in the exhibition. It's titled Contra Naturum, which translates to Against Nature. And it intersperses footage of Davian sort of dancing and moving within the tight confines of this historic ice house with footage of ice sailing. So these sort of sweeping vistas of ice. And so that's how their collaboration began.
It's interesting to me that the inspiration for this comes from that debate, and that debate occurred in 1987. That's a long time ago.
Yes.
On Nightline, on ABC's Nightline, between James F. Buckley, who was a noted conservative, and it could be argued that he was somewhat effete. And he had this. He was talking to this sailor who blind who attempted to do a transatlantic crossing. He was not successful, but it wasn't because he was blind. He was unsuccessful because his the device that he used to speak to get his coordinates stopped working. The
Right.
technology failed. He
Yes.
didn't fail. And Buckley suggested, as you say, that he could not possibly have enjoyed sailing because of his lack of sight, and that this effort went, as you say, against nature, hence the name of this exhibit. And he fired back, the sailor fired back, telling Buckley, quote, "You're a lot more blind than I am because you can't see what a person can do in my circumstances."
Right.
That's pretty powerful stuff.
It's very powerful. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And I, you know, I'm so glad that we have that video installation on view in our exhibition. So that started Janet's relationship with Davian. And since then, you know, they've done a number of projects together. So it's been really just wonderful working with them on this show.
And I also understand that the museum and other museums have come to understand the need for this type of experience to be available to museum goers because of a 2020 survey that museums took of museum-going blind adults. And they found out because of this survey that they are eager to engage with art, but they feel unwelcome in museums. So is this the first foray into fixing that problem?
Well, I think that there is no easy fix to that problem. I think that that's an ongoing, ever-evolving thing. You know, the Bechtler has always, you know, kind of aimed to be accessible to all audiences, but that's, you know, that's always a work in progress. And in this particular exhibition definitely prompted us to think more about accessibility in museums and inclusion. So some of the things that we have been doing include creating a social narrative, which is essentially a friendly kind of know before you go guide for people who, especially who have autism or other sensory sensitivities, to, you know what to expect before coming into the museum. We are hoping to get funding to have visual descriptions, which are essentially, you know, descriptions of works of art for blind people and people with low vision to come into the museum. So it's not just about the blind, but about, you know, providing a space that is about connection and that doesn't make anybody feel uncomfortable.
You have about 2 months left to see this because it runs through the 22nd of September at the Bechtler. It's called Collection Reframed. We are here beyond vision, and we're talking about that this morning here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. But I guess my question is, because this is so, it seems to me, groundbreaking and new and different, is this the first attempt that this museum, or any museum for that matter, has made at creating something that is as accessible for the visually impaired as it is for the sighted? Because in this exhibit, you're exhibiting works by Edgar Degas, by Picasso, by Henri Matisse, Andy Warhol, and other contemporary artists that people with sight have seen their works before and know them. So is this the first time?
Well, the idea, this is a first for the Bechtler Museum. The idea of inviting contemporary artists or other creatives to, you know, mine museum holdings is not new, but it is new for the Bechtler. And I think it offers really, really exciting possibilities to, you know, collaborate with others in the art community and with our Charlotte community and with people, you know, who have low vision and, you know, the neurodivergent. I could go on and on. I think that for us, the Collection Reframed series in part really did, you know, come out of a desire to re-examine the stories that museums tell, both through the artworks in their collection, but also how those works are presented. And I think that exhibitions like this, they're a way to foster fresh conversations. And as I said earlier, you know, just to offer different points of access and to expand access for people who may not normally visit a museum.
I have about 15 seconds left, but this is described as the inaugural presentation of the Bechtler's Collection Reframed program. Is there more to come?
Yes, there is. So this series will continue next summer and the summer after that, and I hope indefinitely.
And this is something that can be expanded to the general Beckler collection and not just this particular exhibition.
Absolutely.
Katia Zavistovsky is the curator of the Becklin Museum of Modern Art Collection Reframed. We are here beyond vision. An immersive experience for the sighted and visually impaired runs through the 22nd of September. Thanks for being here.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.